The United States presidential election is on 5 November. Let us get a preview from the former director of African studies at the U.S. Army War College, Colonel Chris Wyatt, retired Colonel Chris Wyatt. Welcome, Colonel.
Well, thank you, Chris. You say retired. While I am retired from active military service, it sure doesn't feel like I'm retired. It's 7 days a week. It's a full court press with everything. Yeah, it's exciting times here in America. By the way, Botswana has their elections coming up on October 30th, right next door to you. So I don't know if we'll talk about that, but I'm certainly happy to discuss America's bat-crap crazy election season.
Well, you spoke at a Trump rally this weekend at which you outlined who is the biggest threat to democracy. Please recap your reasoning for our viewers.
Well, I take it you must have watched that speech. That's why you're asking me. Okay, well, I've never done that before, but I'm a radio host, and one of my co-hosts came down from New Hampshire to Pennsylvania, which is turning out to be apparently the most important state in the union for this election, according to analysts, and that may very well be the case. So a lot of people are flooding into Pennsylvania right now trying to influence the vote, including the Labour Party from the UK, but that's a whole other subject. So I spoke yesterday at this rally. Not many people there. In fact, I opened up my comments saying it resembles a Joe Biden rally. There's almost nobody here. So what I said is, for the better part of the past year, the Democratic Party, Joe Biden and now Kamala Harris keep calling Donald Trump a threat to democracy. Well, first off, we're not a democracy. We don't have mob rule here. Democracy is everybody gets a vote, everybody gets a say, and 50 plus one decides that the other 49 must suffer and bear. We have a representative republic, a constitutional republic, and we send people to represent us, and we actually vote on that. Unlike in South Africa, you vote for party list, we vote for the actual people here. Good or bad, that's the system we have. And so we're not really a democracy as such. We use that term rather loosely. So the real threat to democracy, if Donald Trump is a threat to democracy, the question I ask people is, why are we having elections on November 5th? I mean, he was president, and like Hitler became, the chancellor of Germany, and he never left. And Mussolini became the leader in Italy. He never left. Stalin and the Soviet Union, he never left. They just had, perfunctory elections or didn't have elections. Donald Trump lost an election in 2020 by 40,000 votes in three states out of 50 and left office peacefully. And Joe Biden came in. So if he's a threat to democracy, that doesn't make any sense. The man has a track record. We know what Trump's about. You don't have to like him. You can dislike him. You can hate him. But at least you know what his policies are and what they've been. And now he has even more fascinating policies about limiting taxation on low-income workers who work in the service industry and eliminating taxes on Social Security benefits, which harm seniors, which no one else has talked about in 30 years. So the real threat to democracy is actually the other side. It was the Democratic Party that held primaries in 50 states and four territories, and 14.5 million Democrat voters went to the polls and selected Joe Biden. Overwhelmingly, they wanted Joe Biden to be their candidate. I don't know what's wrong with them. I wouldn't pick Joe Biden, but that was their choice. And then the Democratic Party decided that Joe Biden was a liability. And so in a palace coup, they pushed him aside and convinced the doddering old man it was time to go. And instead of picking somebody that actually had a chance to win this election, like not people I care for, but people who might have a chance, like Gavin Newsom, the governor of California, Gretchen Whitmer, the governor of Michigan, or Josh Shapiro, the governor of Pennsylvania, all of whom are much more favorably rated and have much more success, they went with Kamala Harris, the dumbest box of rocks I've ever met in my life. So they stole the nomination from Joe Biden. They're the threat to democracy. And then I ran through a whole list of things talking about, when Trump came in office, love him or like him, hate him or whatever, peace broke out all over the world. We ended our combat operations in Afghanistan. There hadn't been those for 18 months when Biden withdrew. We ended the conflict in Iraq. We destroyed ISIS in a matter of 4 months, something that cost the lives of hundreds of thousands of people for well over a decade since the Arab Spring, gone in 4 months. And then the historic Abraham Accords, bigger than Camp David. Israel had peace with Morocco, the Emirates. Sudan had a peace agreement with Israel. It's unbelievable. Peace all over the world breaking out. Joe Biden comes in office. The military overthrows the government in Myanmar. He says nothing about it, does nothing about it. They're committing genocide against the Muslim Rohingya there. And the list goes on and on. The hits just keep coming. Niger, Burkina Faso, Mali, Mozambique, Sudan imploding. And then, of course, Ukraine and Gaza. So who's the threat to peace? Who's the threat to freedom and democracy? It's not Donald Trump. And they're just running this narrative. There's a similar thing going on. I spoke to someone last night. A gentleman said, well, I'm voting for Trump, but my wife and daughter are voting for Harris. He said, you know why? I said, yeah, I'm going to guess the issue is a non-relevant issue, abortion. He said, yep, that's what it is. It's all about body autonomy. And I said, well, that's because they lie. I keep saying Donald Trump is going to, you know, have you search, you know, to check your fertility. I mean, it took me 5 months to get an MRI appointment from the government, and I'm retired military. I don't think they're capable of watching your reproductive health on a basis for 380 million women. And on top of that, abortion is not something Trump can regulate, nor can Harris. It's unconstitutional. And so he can't sign a piece of paper with a magic wand and say, oh, abortion's illegal. Plus, this is a non-issue. It's been lied about by Democrats since 2022 when the Dobbs decision came down, overturning Roe versus Wade. That decision sent it back to the states, which is what the Constitution says under the 10th Amendment. And the thing is that not a single state has banned abortion. There have been more restrictive measures placed on some abortions in some states, but every single state in the country, a woman can go for an abortion under certain circumstances. So the whole thing is just a big lie. And that's how they're trying to frighten people. They accuse Trump of being the guy that speaks dark and frightens people. That's exactly what Harris and the Democrats do. While she was speaking the other day, she was talking about how Trump is always calling people names and this, that, the other. And that's all she did in an interview with Brett Baer. She said Donald Trump 21 times. And every time she mentioned his name, she said something evil about him. There you have it.
So who is ahead now, Trump or Harris?
Well, it's a question whether you believe polls or not. And I've noticed that a lot of analysts are finally catching on to this. I'm not exactly an original thought that I had, but many of us noticed this in 2016, again in 2020, and we're seeing it here once more. There is what I call the phantom Trump vote. And that's about 3 to 5% of the people who actually vote. So that's a significant margin in a presidential election. Anything over 2% is significant these days. But 3 to 5% of voters who go to the polls, when they're asked by pollsters and when they talk to people, they never admit that they're going to vote for Trump. He's a thoroughly unlikable guy. I'm afraid I'll lose my job. My goodness, I'll be called a racist if I support him. So they just don't say they're going to vote for Trump. And they tell pollsters that. And then when the election comes down, if you look at at this stage of the race in 2016, Trump was behind nationally for Hillary Clinton by 9 points in the polls. Yet he beat her. Now, she won the popular vote, but that's all because of California. She beat him in California by 5 million votes. If you take California out of the race, it's a complete landslide electoral for Donald Trump, and he wins the popular vote by 1.5 million votes. That's how big California is. So that was 9 points in 2016. In 2020, at this stage, he was 12 points behind Joe Biden. I still scratch my head about that one, but 12 points behind. And in the end, it came down to 40,000 votes out of, you know, almost 200 million people that voted in three states. So he closed that gap. And that 3 to 5% phantom Trump vote plays a difference. I have to frame this by telling you that, Chris. So the situation we have today is that in every major national poll, Trump is ahead 50 to 48 or better in the country. That's never been done before. Trump has never been there before. It's uncharted ground. On top of that, the seven states that will ultimately decide the election because of the vagaries of our, not vagaries, but the way our electoral college system is set up to ensure that small states are represented, those seven battleground states where the election will be decided, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Arizona, Iowa, Georgia, Michigan, those states, Trump is now ahead in every single poll. If we factor in the likely, we can't predict this, but if we make the assumption, which is a valid assumption, that 3 to 5% are hiding their true intentions for Trump, then it goes from a close race to a clear victory for Donald Trump. Look, this is unprecedented, Chris. I have never in my life, and I'll be turning 60 soon, but never in my life ever in a presidential election seen unions not support the Democratic candidate for president. Never seen it. United auto workers, United mine workers, none of them are supporting Kamala Harris. It's unprecedented. It's unheard of. Black men are deserting the Democratic Party in droves. They're tired of being preached to, tired of being told, you know, condescending things like, you know, Barack Obama telling them misogynist if they don't vote for her. And Hispanics are turning to Trump in overwhelming numbers. It's almost 50-50. That's unheard of. The best that a Republican president has done with Hispanics in recent history has been George Bush, where he got 45%. And now Trump is going to exceed that. We even have Orthodox Jews turning against the Democratic Party, which is unheard of. This is a really strange situation, but it comes down to the fact that all you have to do is ask yourself the question that Reagan asked in 1984. Are you better off today than you were 4 years ago? In 1984, the answer was yes, we're much better off. Today, we are far worse off. That's all you got to ask. And she is part of this whole process. And, you know, as Donald Trump said on the stage last night, Kamala, you're fired.
Well, you know, one of Trump's biggest cheerleaders has turned out to be South African billionaire Elon Musk. What do you make of his backing for Trump?
Well, first off, let me do a minor correction. He's South African born, but he's an American citizen. So we'll take credit for him now.
He's yours now. Okay.
Yeah. You look, we gave you Trevor Noah back. I think it's a fair exchange.
I'm not sure.
Yeah, no, that's not fair at all.
But you're welcome to take Trevor. But he was one, you know, Trevor Noah once upon a time was entertaining, but he came to America and he just became obnoxious and boring. But so on a more serious note, Elon Musk. So here's the thing about Elon Musk. I'm one of those people that is impressed and respect his entrepreneurial skills, his drive, his ambition. I mean, the guy has stated goals and he set out to achieve them. He's achieved them. Remarkable things. An incredibly fascinating guy and also very fertile, apparently. He's got kids all over the place. But anyway, a whole other story. But he's a fascinating guy. But I never trust Elon Musk fully. And I don't trust any entrepreneurs like this fully because every entrepreneur has got a wackadoodle side about them. And I mean, I saw him on a broadcast where he was talking about, you know, smoking marijuana and kids were listening. I'm like, that's not good judgment. And, you know, there's some things that he says and does that he talks about Twitter being a free speech platform. It's not. It's still regulated in ways that don't make it a free speech platform. But it's much better than it once was. And, you know, now everybody can call everybody names, not just conservatives being attacked. But the support for Trump, I'm not surprised. I'm not surprised because Elon Musk was the darling of the political left. As long as he had his headquarters in California, he did what he was told to do, and he just behaved. But the moment he started pushing back against the censorship regime that's been going on, suddenly his company's under attack. He's evil, this, that, and the other. The thing about Elon Musk is that he's a fascinating guy, but he's right about a lot of things, you know? And I think that the backing for Trump is not a surprise. Some other very wealthy people backing Trump, Sheldon Adelson's wife, widow, the owner of the casino system out there in Nevada. It's also, I think she's put $95 million in the campaign. But the real backing here is the oligarchs, the big dogs. You guys in South Africa, Bell Pottinger might call the white monopoly capital, that sort of crowd. You know, they're not really white monopoly capital. But you get my point, the big corporate interests in America. All the money for those guys goes to the Democrats, Wall Street, the big corporations. And why is that? Big corporations love regulation. They can afford to spend $5 million on auditors and accountants. It's the small businesses trying to come up and compete with them with new ideas, better productivity, and more efficient service and better products. And they don't like competition. And that's the case in South Africa. That's the case in Europe. That's the case in America. So the big guys don't like that. They like the party in power that likes to create rules and slow down progress. And Elon Musk is all about getting rid of red tape and all about, you know, making it laissez-faire as best as possible and small government. And in that vein, he and I agree 100%.
Now, what would be the biggest impact on the international political arena and landscape as it is now should Trump regain the White House?
Well, number one, I think the first thing that's going to happen is the energy market's going to calm down immediately. That's going to send some reassurance to the energy market. You know, and it's an odd situation because even under Biden, America's energy production has soared. Now, that's in spite of the Biden administration. It's because of things that were put in place when Trump was there that came into fruition when Biden came in. So we're now the world's largest oil producer, bigger than Saudi Arabia by a few million barrels a day. We're the world's, that was already under Trump, but it got larger. We're also the world's largest energy producer, and we're also one of the world's largest alternative energy producers, although China's got us all beat. So the energy markets will calm down. That will store some stability. That means that likely, you know, commodity prices are going to drop that aren't in demand. Like gold is at $2,700 an ounce right now, but that's artificial, and I think that will ease up a little bit. Beyond that, it'll send a clear message. When Trump was president, they predicted that he would start wars everywhere. When in fact, he ended wars. And they made fun of Trump for, you know, meeting with Kim Jong-un of North Korea. But what happened from that? Well, he stroked Kim Jong-un's ego, which Trump correctly assessed was he wanted to be taken as a serious person on the world stage. And that was enough to get the guy to stop firing ballistic missiles over the sea of Japan, over the surface area of Japan. It's an act of war. And they were testing him, flying him over Japan, endangering lives. And Trump met with the guy and he stopped. You know, so I think that Trump coming to stage will send a clear message to autocrats and to countries around the world. Now, Trump said he can end Ukraine on day one. I think that's a bit of a stretch. I think we're a little too far down the road to end Ukraine on day one. But I do think that there will be a significant change in what happens in Ukraine going forward. And with Israel, Trump is firmly behind Israel, as is Biden, although it's never clear what he really says. But he is behind Israel. I think that with the death of Sinwar, that Israel will continue to go after Hamas. And then once they feel they've got enough, that's just going to taper off. So that's going to end hopefully in the next 3 or 4 months, one would hope, for the tragedy going on there. And that'll coincide with Trump coming in office. So I think the world will calm down in many respects. Trump is being taught, even the Wall Street Journal is saying that Trump's tariffs are crazy. It's going to lead to Smoot-Hawley, the 1930s legislation that caused global trade issues and a slowdown in economic activity. That's not going to happen. What Trump is saying is that, listen, China, you have an 80% tariff on Cadillacs coming to your country. Remove it, or you're getting 80% tariff on this. You know, it's a quid pro quo. And China's economy is not in very good shape right now. The country has all kinds of social chaos, financial issues. They can ill afford to play hardball with the United States. Our economy is okay. It's not great. It's okay. We could probably afford it more than them in the short term. So I think that we'll return to some sense of normalcy. However, that's internationally. Chris, domestically, the lawsuits start immediately. Trump stole the election. Trump's a racist. Everything Trump does, they're going to go to the courts all day long and clog up our court system. And conversely, if Trump does what he should do, and that is go after the people that have illegally, unconstitutionally weaponized the justice system against him and against conservatives in this country, then we're going to see lots of lawfare and legal proceedings domestically. And that will fill up the next 4 years. But it should be interesting.
I'm just wondering, under which presidency do you think we will see the disclosure of the Epstein client list?
Well, I don't think we're ever going to see the disclosure. You know, I don't think we're ever going to see the full disclosure of the P. Diddy client list or the freak-offs. I mean, listen, you know, it's fascinating, Chris, because, you know, you have people out there that they're called conspiracy theorists because they come up with these wild, crazy ideas like NASA is cloud seeding the Western Cape. Look, there's a plane flying on the tracks. NASA announced the program. It's a matter of public information. It's doing terrain mapping of the fynbos, you know, to help South Africa's biodiversity. And it's been going on for some time. But people come up with conspiracy theories, and it's strange because some of them tend to be correct over time. I remember a few years ago when I started doing my broadcast on YouTube after retiring from active service, and someone came on and accused me of the usual things, you know, and then they said, you know, you're a QAnon. I'm like, what? Is that an insult? What's a QAnon? I never heard of that before. Anyway, so I looked it up, and I found out there was some conspiracy theorist, the supposedly extreme right wing. And anyway, I'm like, I never even heard of the guy. How can I be part of that? Well, that guy proposed a lot of theories, apparently, and some of them came true, one of which was people involved sex scandals, politicians and celebrities, the music industry, television, and a lot of powerful people. And then we have Epstein, and he dies. And his client list is still not released. And now we've got Puff Daddy, Sean Combs. By the way, the Puff Daddy thing has been talked about for years. Some people have been telling people that this has been going on for a long time. First off, you had the so-called white parties. Now, in a South African context, I can understand people think that's racist. White parties. If they all were white, that was his theme. But I just making a joke there. I don't know if it was a dad joke. But anyway, so the white parties, but that's apparently not where most of the sex stuff took place. Some of it did take place there. And that's where a lot of the big name celebrities showed up. But then he had these things called freak-offs, and that's where the baby oil, and we're not going to get into that, all the other stuff. There's in the media, credible media reports about underage boys and girls being drugged into this, some big-name celebrities. I think a lot of people want to know because I think a lot of trust is going to be broken with an awful lot of people when we find out who is engaged in this stuff. It's pretty sick and twisted, and I don't think, honestly, that we're going to find out the Epstein client list or the Puff Daddy, you know, invitee list. This seems to me the elites covering up for the elites all over the world. That's pretty scary.
We've seen that happen in more than one country, Chris. So what would a Trump victory mean for South Africa?
Probably not a whole lot in the short term. First off, South Africa was not removed from the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act, which should have been the case. I know I'm going to get hate mail for that, but I'm just being objective here. I don't want to see South Africa removed from it, but it should have been removed. South Africa has violated the terms of AGOA. And before you're going to get some hate mail, well, we don't need AGOA. Who do you think you are dictating South Africa? I'm not dictating anything. Listen to me, brother and sister. We give you duty-free access to our marketplace, and all we ask is you meet some governance standards. Voluntary. If you achieve them, we let you on the list. As long as you comply by them, you can stay there and you can send your BMW parts from Port Elizabeth into South Carolina to build BMWs with no duty, which the Germans don't get to do and their BMW. Anyway, so, you know, it's a gift we give because we hope to improve things in Africa for Africans. A lot of people miss that. They seem to think that we need it. We don't need a AGOA. We get no benefit out of a AGOA. In fact, we got an ANC calling us all kinds of names and we're supposed to be getting good relations out of it. So it doesn't work well. I think that because South Africa remains in a AGOA, that will be good for South Africa. And the Lady R incident will be forgotten about. A lot of these problems that are out there will be forgotten about. The fact that the ANC has entered into a government of national unity, or as I'm starting to call it, the government of national co-op, co-opting. That's what I'm starting to call it. Because that's happened, I think it takes a lot of the pressure off. The ANC can blame its partners, or it can say, well, that was in the past. Now we're in a government national unity. Give us time. And that's going to give South Africa's government time to skate unnoticed, I think, for the next, until the municipal elections. That's my thoughts on it. And Trump, it's not going to be a big focus. You have to understand, as I said, the day Trump comes in office, he'll either be facing assassination attempts, as he's already happened twice now, or he'll be facing lawsuits over and over again, and he'll be focused on trying to fix things. We've got some real problems in this country, not the least of which is our debt, which nobody's talking about, and the devaluation of the dollar. But I think that South Africa-U.S. relationship, it depends who he appoints as ambassador to South Africa. Hopefully it's not, you know, somebody makes handbags, Lana Marks. I am available, Don, if you're looking for an ambassador to South Africa. Just throwing that one out there. But it would be nice to have someone that's grounded in reality and can interact with folks on that level. But I think that's if we get, because, you know, that's a political appointment. Our ambassadors work where two-thirds of them are State Department career diplomats, and then one-third of them around the world are political appointees. South Africa traditionally has always been a political appointee. And Lana Marks got it because she was a big contributor and a high society friend of Trump. And so she got it because she was born there. Although apparently her Xhosa is not very good. She claims she spoke it, it's not very good. Anyway, the point is that if Trump picks the right person politically to be the ambassador of South Africa, it could make a world of difference in our relations going forward.
You mentioned the upcoming election in Botswana. What is the U.S. expecting there?
Actually, I think the United States is asleep. Maybe a few people in the State Department are aware about it, but I don't think the United States is paying any attention to it. I am definitely paying attention to it, and I'm a bit frustrated, and I'm also very outspoken about what's happened in Botswana since Ian Khama left. In the interest of full disclosure, I like President Khama. I've interviewed him in person and also distance before. I have a great deal of respect for him. When I was stationed in Botswana, working with the governor of Botswana at the embassy and meeting Khama and other members of his government, he was frequently attacked by his opponents as being, you know, running the government like a dictator because he's a military general. That is not at all what happened. He just ran his political party like the leader of a political party and expected people to behave and live up to standards, moral standards and, you know, legal standards. And when they did, you know, he called them out. And the same thing in government. But he's always been accused of that. But he handpicked a successor, as the Botswana Democratic Party tends to do, before he left office. That was Mokgweetsi Eric Masisi. Masisi came in, it was Khama's choice, and almost immediately had buyer's remorse. Masisi turned on Khama and started attacking him ostensibly to promote himself. I don't know why. It was a foolish move. And then he eventually even went on to trump up criminal charge against Khama for weapons on his ranch and this, that, and the other. And then, of course, Khama had to leave the country for a while. Well, he's back in the country now. The arrest warrant for him has been rescinded. He's out there campaigning for an opposition party. And I think the charge is going to be dismissed, too. It's all political from my perspective. The U.S. is not really paying much attention to it. And it's a shame because Botswana, since 1966, has been the most reliably successful, honest, largely corruption-free, democratic country in Africa, bar none, except maybe Mauritius. You throw Mauritius or Cape Verde there. But it has just been head and shoulders above the rest. Unfortunately, under Masisi, lots of corruption has crept in. And the governor of Botswana's draconian approach to COVID was especially disheartening. They created zones, you know, in towns. You couldn't go from this neighborhood to the other or you would be arrested. You couldn't travel to see your family. And of course, you know how Southern Africa is. People live in the capital and they have to go back, you know, on the farm to their family, to their ranch. They've got obligations. And it was just disastrous. And Botswana's just suffered as a consequence of it. Also, they have their bans on South African fruit and vegetable imports, which means that people can't get your fruit and vegetables because Botswana can't produce enough. So you go to Pick and Pay and the shelves are bare. Meanwhile, in Rustenburg, there's plenty of bananas and plenty of apples and plenty of pears and strawberries, but not in Gaborone or Francistown or Maun. The country's headed in the wrong direction. And I can't predict it because there are no reliable polls, but there is a distinct possibility the Botswana Democratic Party, for the first time in history, may find itself in the same situation as the ANC, not a majority party, but a plurality party, and a coalition may be necessary. That may be the case. Let's see what happens.
Thank you. That was the former director of African Studies at the U.S. Army War College, retired Colonel Chris Wyatt, speaking to BizNews, and I'm Chris Stain. Thank you, Colonel.
You're very welcome, Chris. Thank you very much. Have a good day. God bless. And hey, Christmas is coming up. It's right around the corner.
We'll speak before then. You're going to have an election result to discuss.
That's very true. We'll see how it goes.